But many years went by, and then the decision to move out to Tallaght. Now, you oversaw that transition, or did you?
Well, the factory was more or less divided into three sections, and three of the engineers each had a section to deal with. My section was the raw ingredients that came in up to the end of the dough mixing and then the ovens. So then I explain. Biscuits are made from basically flour, fat, syrup and water. And these ingredients have to be sort of added into this big mixer. A dough mixer, which you have in Jacobs, is 1,600 pounds, which is sort of nearly a ton. So it would make a ton of dough at a sitting. It would take about eight or 10 minutes to do. So these are great big things, like about half the size of a domestic room. And these would sit there, and all the pipes then would send all the ingredients into this big yolk, which had a bowl, which mixed the stuff around, and finally when it turned into flour, the front would fall down, and out would come a huge blob of flour, which was cut in half and went into, of dough, which was cut in half, and then went into two of these big metal sort of trolleys, which carried it away to the main thing. And this trolley then sat on a machine, which lifted it up in the air, turned it upside down, and then the dough flopped into the part of the machine which was for making biscuits. So this big lump of dough was rolled flat and came by, and all they stamped out the biscuits with a huge big stamper, and then what was left over, the cuttings went off to one side and re-added it to the next mix, and the biscuit shapes went into the oven, and the oven could be anything up to about 200 feet long, and then they came out at the far end, of course, and they went to other things.
So that idea, that making of biscuits, did it continue the same way in the new factory outside in Tallaght?
Yes and no. The same things happened, except that the element of the manual thing was missing. When I joined in the 1960s, I remember seeing guys carrying bags of flour on their shoulders, and these were carried up and put into various things, and off the flour went and was used to make the biscuits. In the Tallaght situation, what we had was a silo, a big tall building, about 100 feet tall, and we had round silos, four round silos in that, each containing 100 tons of flour. And what would happen then, you see, is that a flour lorry would come up, couple up to this yoke on the wall, it would blow its contents into this big, huge, tall silo. And then later on, he goes home, you now have your silo full of flour. Now, when the mixer says, I want to make biscuits, the guy in front of the mixer, instead of having to bring a sack of flour, he just presses a button. And the amount of flour required comes to, blown through tubes, lands in the mixer, because each ingredient is tubed from its storage space right to the mixer, whether it's syrup, fat, flour, or whatever it is, or water, or sugar. So the same things happened, except these happened in a situation where you didn't have to do it manually.
It was more mechanical rather than mechanical.
It was electrical and electronic, because what happened is, I don't want to go into too much detail, but basically we used to weigh and then send the weighment across. But the distance between the weighment and the mixer was so big that things didn't arrive with the correct weight. They sort of lost halfway or something happened. So what they did is they turned each mixer that was put up onto sort of stilts and turned into a weigher itself. Yeah. So instead of calling for 400 pounds of flour, you called for 400 flour. And then the thing said 400 pounds. So the flour kept coming until the mixer said, oh yeah, it's a bit like the domestic scales. The kid just said, yeah, I've got 100, I've got 400 things of flour, stop. The thing stopped. So that was very interesting to me as an engineer, conversion of these old-fashioned mixers, sitting them up on load cells so that they now became weighing machines, and how all the stuff was blown from the silo and stuff like that. So there was lots and lots of detail like that.
Were you involved in the manufacturing of the drawings or the early stages?
Yes, because you'd have to know what you wanted. You define your requirements. Then you go to specialist suppliers in the UK and say, we want to do this. Now, they have stuff to do it, but you have to match it into your factory. So there's a whole lot of me going across to the UK, them coming across here, doing a lot of measurements and so on and so forth. And finally, you get an agreement what's to be done, and then the stuff is sent across, hopefully on time, and then it's installed, and then you've got to get it working. Each phase of that has a problem, and you have to solve the problems.
Was that satisfying, to see it from its conception to its actual...
Very. that was one of the things I really enjoyed, because, I mean, you came, when I came out to Tala first, the factory, which was about, roughly about half a mile long, it's a huge factory, it's one of the biggest factories in Ireland, it was about half a mile long and it was about 217 feet wide. So basically it was Jacob's factory flattened out with a steamroller, and it was so long and it was so wide, everything was on the ground floor. Now, the thing about that was, when we went up there, we were one of the engineers with the early bunch. They were all working away in Bishop Street, but we had to sort of start off this new thing and get things installed and working. And there was no walls at either end. And I was saying to him, it was the biggest wind tunnel in Europe. Because you'd go in there, you want three overcoats on you. Because Tala is a special place. It's rain ciders in Tala. Yeah. Some of my daughters used to laugh at me when I said that. They moved to Tala, they realised it's something like the way it scoots down off the mountains. The rain is... Anyway, you were in this thing, and you were frozen cold, even though it was you were inside. But eventually the walls went up, and we got all that sort of stuff going. And it was very satisfying to see it from an empty shell to a working biscuit factory. And as gradually as the Mary's machines got going, little clumps of people came from Bishop Street up to Tala, put their own skill and expertise and got the thing sorted out. So each machine was, if you like, commissioned one after another. And this was great. We felt really good about this.
Well, that transition took 7 years, approximately, I think, by the time...
I'm not sure how long it took, but it took a long time, yeah.
And by the time you were there and you were set up and ready to continuing... Did the business improve? You know, did you see, was there the same amount of biscuits being sold?
I don't know the full details of this, but I do know that there was a huge money problem around the time we started to move to Tala. Various things had happened, and there was various things that happened in the financial front, with the result that we had actually to go back to suppliers and say, instead of sending us 4 of these things, only send us 2. Lots and lots of these phone calls. And they were saying, do you realise that if we only sell you 2, the cost is going to go up by another 70% for each of these items? And I go back to my boss and say, this is what they've said to this. He said, doesn't matter, there's no money, can't. So we had to chop. And we had to do a sort of a reduced version of the factory for quite a while until money became sort of available again. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge, big problem in terms... There was also the problem, incidentally, of where the skilled labour force lived, because Bishop Street is in the middle, of course, around Peter Street area, and that's where all the people get. Now, if you move to Tala and you've no people to run the factory, what do you do? So, but they did do a huge survey of the employees, and they found that the sort of centre of gravity of the employees' homes had moved from the old-fashioned homes around Bishop Street out to places like Crumlin and so on and so forth. So a lot of people lived there, and it was as near to go to Tala from Crumlin as was from Crumlin to Bishop Street. So they were really pleased to find that, if you like, the centre of gravity of their employees was between the old and the new factory, which is a very significant factor because, as I say, people, you can't just open a biscuit factory and get a guy to press a button. You need skills. I would say probably about 80% of the factory transferred, their employees transferred from...
And did they move lock, stock and barrel? Did they move family, home?
No. Well, the point I was making really was that their houses, their newer houses, were sort of halfway between the old factory and the new factory. They had already moved to estates on the outskirts of Dublin.
With the intention, knowing...
No. That was just natural causes.
Oh, I see.
So you didn't actually have to do anything in a sense.
I see.
You actually said, availed of this very delightful fact that that they actually lived near
that migration was already taking place.
They lived a lot nearer to Tala than they would have if they had lived around Bishop Street.
Yeah. It was like a marriage bureau. There was a lot of marriages made in Jacob's.
Absolutely. Marriages and other liaisons, may I say. Yes, a lot of people. And in fact, the funny thing about it was that it ran in families too. And you heard the family name, they had the grandfather, the father and the son all worked in Jacob's. So, you know, it's sort of, the job was almost passed on from father to son, because obviously if a guy is going to sit in HR and the fellow comes in and said, I'm the son of Joe Soap who's been here for 30 years, you had an in immediately. They knew that you knew the factory and you knew what it was all about, and the family knew what Jacob's was, and this guy was already a Jacob's man, although outside the front door, and he'd come in and he'd get the job.
But that wasn't your case now.
No, I
think your father didn't work.
My father was an accountant. He came from Cove and Cork, yeah. And he knew nothing about anything in engineering. In fact, he was not a practical man. He used to do painting. My mother was a marvellously practical woman, and she did everything in the house. She wouldn't let him near anything. And I remember him painting a door once, and the following day the paint all fell off in one sheet because he hadn't done any preparation. But anyway, so engineering didn't run in. Well, it sort of did run in my family because his brother was an engineer in the RAF and various other people. So the genes obviously had something to do with it.
Where did the parcels originally come from? I mean, are they...
Well, I think they came from France or somewhere originally. They landed in Kilkenny anyway, a lot of them. And I was always very interested in the family tree and discovered that the name Purcell came from Porcus, a pig, which I think I tried to suppress this information. But anyway, yes, so they landed somewhere in Kilkenny and then they sort of drifted around and ended up in Cove. Anyway, some of them ended up in Cove.
Mm-hmm. But the being a Jacobs person, I mean, was that a very... special thing? Walking around town.
There were people who sort of carried it around like a wraith around them, but I never had any. I had never a sense of that at all. No, I was so very pleased to work in a place like Jacobs because it was a lovely place. The guys that I met, the tradesmen that I met, they were amazing. A, what they could do, and B, the sense of humour that they had. There was crack from morning to night, and you knew when you went out on a job it was going to be enjoyable. That because of that. Now there were one or two guys who wouldn't move, even if they were like sort of useless. But the majority of them were very good craftsmen and very funny. And but mind you, I can say that the engineers that I met in, they were all a bit weird because they all had a huge sense of humour. I remember one time there was in the office area there was a gentleman in charge of. Clarker Works, and he had his name on the door inside, and big sort of old-fashioned wooden things, panelled office with glass on the top and panelling underneath. And of course, we crept out when he was still in the office. We unscrewed the handle and his nameplate and moved it from the door to the next bright thing, which was a fixture. And then we sort of stood back, and somebody arrived up and knocked at the door to come in. Do come in. And of course, the guy was pulling the handle, which was on the fixed section of the panel as opposed to the door. And then, of course, we ran for our lives. And the other one, this is typical engineering sort of, things that we used to do on the side. Jacob's colour was sort of yellow. And I remember the chief engineer got a new car, and he was parked in a sort of a place where the guys were doing painting. So, yeah, painting yellow. So somebody else had the idea of getting punch clippings, an office punch, all these sort of little circular round things, yellow shape, basically licking them and sticking them all over your man's bonnet. So, of course, he came down to go home and he had an absolute seizure, jumped up and down, all the paint spots on my lovely new car. And, of course, as he drove out to Howth, the wind blew them all off and that was the end of it. But he knew that we had done it but could not prove it. So that was just one of many things like that.